On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Rivers may be made for swimming, but Americans haven't done much of that in a long time. Too dirty, too scary. Akiko Bush took the plunge and kept on swimming across the Hudson and the Delaware, the Monongahela, the Susquehanna, the Connecticut, and the Current, and the Cheat, and the Mississippi, and she lives to tell about it, and about the rivers, and ourselves. This hour on Point, crossing rivers, lazy and otherwise, with a river-crossing pilgrim. Joining me now is Akiko Bush, river swimmer and author of the new book, Nine Ways to Cross a River, Midstream Reflections on Swimming and Getting There from Here. Akiko Bush, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks so much. I'm happy to be here.
My sister-in-law looked at the book and said, oh my gosh, this is the Forrest Gump of rivers. Are you just out there swimming and swimming and swimming?
Whenever I can.
What got you started on this crossing river quest?
Well, what got me started, there was no eureka moment in terms of wanting to jump into the Hudson. I've spent most of my life in the Hudson Valley, and I'm a swimmer. It's the one sport I do. So I think the idea had always been there to kind of get in the river, jump in it, swim down it, swim across it. It's always just been there in my mind. I think if there was any kind of eureka moment, it was when I realized it could be done. That happened in a couple of ways. The first was that I was sitting in a house of a friend of mine who lives on the river, and I said something about wanting to swim, and he said, oh, sure, no problem, we can do that. But the second thing that happened was I called, when I realized it was probably in the realm of possibility, I called someone, an official at the Department of, I think it was the Marine Recreation in Albany, just to find out if it was really something you could do. And I just figured he would say, oh, forget it, nothing doing, it's illegal, it's too dirty, it's too fast, it's too strong, it's too everything, don't even think about it. But in fact, he said, oh, that sounds like a great idea. And he gave me some really good advice about how to do it safely. And then he said, have a great time. And I figured if someone from Albany was saying, have a great time, go jump in the river,
maybe
it could be done. Yeah.
So there's the practicalities. And we're going to get in the river with you in just a moment and think about and how it's done and feel what it feels like to do it. But, I mean, I'm reading here, and you're presenting it as also a kind of life passage, and not just a single life passage, a kind of life moment. Is that just gussied up Zen talk for the book, or were you at a moment where you needed to swim rivers?
No, that was true. I was approaching my 50th birthday, and my kids were approaching their 13th birthday. I have twin boys who are approaching adolescence. A close friend had died, and you know, I felt that I had these kind of divides in my life that I couldn't do anything about. And so I just thought, well, find a divide that can be crossed. You know, find a river. So that was actually all part of it.
And you did. Plant our feet on that riverbank. How wide the Hudson, the first of eight rivers that you cross in nine crossings here, and we'll talk about that. But how wide, how busy, you know, barges, boats, scum, sweet smelling, or what it looked like?
All of that. Well, the first swim was across the Hudson at New Hamburg. New Hamburg's probably about 60 or 70 miles north of Manhattan. Mm-hmm. And it's on a promontory that kind of juts out into the river. So the width of the river right there is really only about half a mile.
Okay.
So it wasn't a long swim, certainly. And the safety tips I'd gotten from Albany included doing it at slack tide. The Hudson is a tidal river, and so the current can be very, very strong. But if you do it at slack tide, you know, just when the tide is turning, then the river can be quite placid, almost like a lake.
The river that runs both ways.
The river that runs both ways, indeed. Yeah.
So
we timed it for slack tide, and we had an escort boat. And what was the other thing? Oh, yeah. He said, time your swim for early on a weekday morning so you don't run into a lot of recreational river traffic. So we did that as well. And it worked out. I'm here to tell the tale.
Now, I was trying to decide as I began to read about your many river crossings, you know, how I felt about it. The 23-foot fiberglass powerboat that accompanied you across here was Gross Envy, named Gross Envy.
Right.
And I thought at first, I'm pretty envious. But then I thought, you know, I mean, our perception of many, most American rivers sometimes is that these are kind of, or have been, running sewers. And I wasn't sure if I was envying you or not. Should I?
Yes, you should absolutely be envying me deeply and profoundly.
Okay.
That is certainly the perception of most American waterways, and with good reason. For many years, up until recently, these rivers were way too dirty to get into. But since the passage of the Clean Water Act some 35 years ago, the rivers have been getting cleaned up, and I don't want to give the impression in any way that restoration is done and that they are cleaned up. But the process has begun. It's constant. It's as constant as the rivers themselves. But they are getting cleaner. And many of them are clean enough to swim in, and certainly the Hudson is.
And yours ran a gamut from pretty sweet to kind of stinky on the Hudson, on the many other rivers. Were you in sweatsuit and, I don't know, face mask and snorkel and antibiotic gel, or did you just put
Absolutely
on your swimsuit and
not.
Plunge in?
Nothing doing. Swimsuit and plunged in. I know. I have to explain that none of these were tremendous athletic challenges. I mean, there's a guy named Chris Swain who swims the length of various different American rivers to make. He's an environmental activist, and it's kind of to make a statement. And he does that. He wears a wetsuit, and he really kind of braces himself against what he's going to find. My swims were much lesser than those, and so no, I just put a bathing suit on and jumped in.
You're not the only one who's done it. We've got callers who already want to dive in with you. Let's go to Columbia, South Carolina,
okay.
And Michael. Michael, you're on the air with Akiko Bush.
Yes, ma'am. I enjoy your show a good bit, and I'm a river runner myself. About every weekend, I go down to Saluda River in Columbia here and swim it. And it's really pretty committed. The humidity is god-awful here, and it's just a good way to cool off.
But why the river, Michael? You could head for a lake. I suppose you could head for the ocean. Why do you choose to go into the river?
10 minutes from my house, and the river water comes from the lake, the bottom of a dam.
Do people look at you like you're crazy when they see you swimming in it, or is everybody in there?
Everyone's in there. There's about 100 people out there a day.
That's fantastic. Good. So the perception down there is that the river's clean enough to get into?
Yes, ma'am. We, also use rafts and inner tubes and float down the river.
Excellent.
Sounds good to me.
It's a five-hour inner tube trip right down the river.
That sounds great, Michael. Thanks very much for sharing that picture. It's hot and it's humid, and Michael goes straight in the river. But you write and remind us, Aki Bush, that many Americans do not and would not dream of it.
Well, that's the legacy of decade upon decade of toxic waste being flushed into the rivers. I mean, people, as I say, had that perception, and it's based on fact. But again, they are getting cleaned up, and that's one of the things I had hoped to address in this book, because while for me it became, you know, it started as kind of a, you know, it was kind of about a personal sense of restoration, what I found very quickly was that each of these river communities I visited were going through their own kind of restoration or reclamation. And what I was experiencing on a very small personal level was kind of echoed in this broader community level on the river banks. And I guess that's when I decided there was a bigger story here than just my little voyage.
Help us feel the personal part. Take us into the tactile experience. The Hudson was your first. What did it feel like? What were you watching out for? How's it compare to a pool or a lake or the ocean? You went with some others at your side. What was the sensation of being there mid-Hudson River?
I think when you just asked the previous caller, you know, why a river rather than a lake or a pool or a pond, there's something about being in a river that you know you're in water that's coming from one place and going something else. And so it has this grand sense of energy and animation and momentum, and you really just feel like you're kind of in one of, you know, life's major arteries. I mean, I know that sounds a little schmaltzy, but that's, you know, it's really kind of the way you feel. And the Hudson, my first river, was a little bit salty. Maybe I just imagined that because we were about 60 or 70 miles north of the ocean, but it's still tidal up there. So it felt a little bit brackish and sweet and salty. The Hudson is a very, it's not a clear river. There's so much aquatic life in it that the minute you put your head underwater, you don't see anything. You don't see much. I mean, other rivers have a real sense of clarity to them. Mm-hmm. But part of the beauty of the Hudson is that sense of obscurity. So that was one of the things that made the Hudson very different.
You're generous in quoting others who have written about rivers as well. William Leistheat Moon saying, "A river with its attendant cascades, eddies, boils, and whirlpools is the most expressive aspect of a natural landscape, for nothing else moves so far, so broadly, so unceasingly, so demonstrably, and nothing else is so susceptible to personification and so much at the heart of our notions about life and death." That sounds like heavy stuff you're wading into.
Well, he writes so beautifully about travel and waterways, and his own book River Horse about American waterways was certainly inspiring to me. So, of course, I had to quote him. But what he says is absolutely true. I mean, I think that's one reason, you know, no matter how people feel the river is dirty and you shouldn't go anywhere near it or certainly not get into it, most people who live in waterfront communities feel a tremendous sense of stewardship towards their rivers. And I think it's not just that you live near the river and see how beautiful it is. It's because there's something in the image of a river that resonates for all of us.
Francis is calling from Baltimore County in Maryland. Francis, you're on the air with Akiko Bush.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Pretty good. What do you know?
When I was a kid, I used to fish and swim in Shenandoah, the Upper Potomac, and the Susquehanna a lot. And one of the things I imagined myself as was a catfish, so I would have an idea of where's the best place to fish. And what I would do is, before I even started fishing, I would jump in the river and I would dive down to the bottom, and goggles or no goggles, I would open my eyes and just think about being a catfish or being whatever.
Oh, Francis, and I love it. Did you feel the big whiskers and the mud on your belly?
I absolutely, it was something nearly metaphysical about the whole experience, you know, like, because the river's so mysterious anyway, and you look at it from the surface and you just feel this great sense of what's down there. And then you go down there and you say, well, now I'm a part of that mystery. And it's just something that I've never stopped doing. I always do it every chance I get. Whenever I have a chance to go to one of these rivers in my area, I jump in.
Oh, Francis, you're a river god. You're a great catfish. And thanks for taking us down there with you. Akiko Bush, Francis is kind of singing your song here.
I want to swim with that guy. Are you kidding? He sounds great, yeah.
But he says part of what it is about the rivers, you don't know what's down there. You write the same thing that many people are apprehensive, you write, because they can't see and know what's beneath them. You say, hey, they're full of promise and possibility, reaffirming the fact that we live with the unknown in everything we do.
Yeah, I think Francis really said it. He said it really beautifully. Yeah, the mystery of what's down there. I mean, I think a lot of people are nervous about swimming in open water for that, because they're nervous about that sense of mystery. But for me and for Francis, we like that. We like that sense of unknown. So that's part of the experience.
He swims the Susquehanna. You did too. What was that crossing like?
I loved going there, but I have to say the Susquehanna, more than any other river, seems to have this legacy of absolute toxicity. I mean, everyone we met just said, don't do it. Don't go anywhere near it. You can die in that river. So that was interesting. It really made us kind of, in confronting everyone else's fear about it, kind of made us confront our fear about it. And then, after a couple of days, because we'd gotten there early and we had to find a place to swim. So, after a couple of days of this, and then finally finding a place to get in the river, it was so benign. It was so gentle. It was
Where did you
sweet.
Get in? Pinpoint it for us, geographically. Pin a picture.
We were in a campground in a place called Winfield, which was above Sunbury, which is where the two branches of the river meet.
Where is that? Near state borders or cities? Place it for us.
Oh, let's see. It's above, oh gosh, I want to say about 100 miles above Harrisburg.
Okay.
I'm not sure if that's quite right, but something like that.
Okay.
So it's not, it wasn't as wide as it is down there, but it was fairly deep. I mean, we couldn't touch bottom. We were definitely swimming. but it was, you know, it just didn't once we got in there, that sense of danger we kept hearing about vanished.
And the toxic reputation that was put in front of you, did you find that? Did you swim in it, or was it different?
No, we didn't find that at all. And later on, what I did was I called someone at the EPA over there, and he said, no, you're fine. He said, swimmers don't drink a lot of the water. You're totally fine swimming in the river. But I think the Susquehanna really represents a lot of different sources of pollution. I mean, obviously, you've got Three Mile Island down there. Yeah. Besides that, there is mine drainage. There's a kind of history of industrial abuse, and then there's a lot also there's a lot of agricultural waste that did wash into the river, and then as in other rivers, you have a lot of outdated municipal sewage treatment plants. So you've kind of got the whole thing there. You know, everything that could pollute a river, it's all been there. So I think that's another reason that river was really, people just said, oh, forget it. You know, don't go near it.
Yeah, that may have been the strongest message at the Susquehanna, but you ran into this again and again. You describe how every time you'd show up somewhere and say, I'm going in, people would say, are you crazy? Are you kidding? The sign at the Delaware River, absolutely no swimming in the Delaware River. And that was the message you almost always got when you showed up.
Well, the Delaware, it wasn't about how polluted it was. The Delaware, it was really just more about how dangerous the current could be. And it, you know, it has very unexpected pools and eddies. And it's great for canoeing and kayaking, but they discouraged swimming because they felt that it was unsafe for those reasons. The Mississippi, obviously, was thought to be unsafe for a whole, you know, myriad other reasons.
Yeah, we'll look at that one. That's the big one. But what about this first response? Why do you think people close to the river were always warning you away from swimming it? Almost all of them.
You know, I'm probably the wrong person to ask. I don't know. As far as the Delaware goes, the Delaware, I think it's where we were. The upper Delaware is a known recreational destination. There's a lot of boating up there, and I think a lot of times maybe people jump in who aren't strong swimmers and who don't know what they're doing and who maybe get caught in the current. So I think it's, you know, fair enough to discourage people from being quite so cavalier about jumping into the river. On the other hand, if you are a strong swimmer, it to me is an opportunity missed.
Take us down another big one, the Connecticut. Comes down, of course, Vermont-New Hampshire border there through Massachusetts. Connecticut gets to be a great big wide river. Where'd you cross and how was it?
Well, the Connecticut River, we were up in Hadley. The Connecticut River had a whole different feel to it. I guess that was the third river we were in. And very shallow, very gentle, very leisurely. We swam across it, and it was such a gentle, sweet river that we just decided to swim down it. And you could, you know, it was one of those rivers you could barely feel the current. But, of course, we were going downstream. If we'd been trying to swim upstream, we would have felt it. But the whole thing was so kind of leisurely and easy that it was, there was nothing athletic about it. It wasn't challenging at all. It was just kind of a summer afternoon floating down the river.
You remind us that it was once famously called the best landscaped sewer in the nation on your crossing?
Absolutely not. No. It's definitely been cleaned up and clean enough to swim in. I mean, that was in the 19th century and well into the 20th century, there were many, many mills and factories and, you know, industrial plants that just dumped their waste into the river. That is largely regulated now and is no longer something as a swimmer, or at least in the upper part of the river where we were, that you need to be concerned about.
A sweet swim across and maybe down on this one, the Connecticut River. Let's take a call from Panama City, Florida. Bob, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just got in on this a little bit ago, and I'm assuming that this lady's kind of talking about all rivers. But my issue is with these environmental wacko groups that get out here and start talking about all the problems that we have with everything in the country and the world. And, you know, clearly it'd be nice to go back to the dinosaur age to where everything was kind of pristine, but, you know, that's impossible to do. But I don't see the problem that, you know, that you are discussing, which obviously this lady in her book is trying to discount some of this stuff by saying, well, sure, get out there and have fun, recreate.
Yes, she is. Yes, she is.
Do all that kind of thing. So that's nice. And we need more of that, because these environmental groups get out there. They get all this Pew Foundation money, all these foundation money they get coming in here. They put up some kind of targeted, real bad picture out on the web or on a magazine and say, send us $5. So they get a million members to send them $5. And they get on these crusades, and they take total common sense and reality out of the situation.
But, Bob, do we owe them something for crusading? I mean, rivers did used to catch fire, and I've been to many a river where the sign said, do not eat fish from this river. I don't like seeing that.
Well, you see, I'm in the fishing business,
but of course, I'm
fishing in the Gulf of Mexico,
and
we see this now. You see warnings out here for mercury and king mackerel and red snapper and swordfish. You go back and you do the studies that are out there. Clearly, you have studies from the Seychelles Islands, and there's another group of islands out there in the ocean. One group of islands, people have mercury, they turn into mongoloids. Another group of islands, they do mercury, they turn out to be geniuses. So you've got counter studies, and basically what it gets down to is when you really study this and you see the situation. I've eaten king mackerel all my life. I'm not a real smart person. I think I'm fairly intelligent, but I don't see the effects of mercury on here. The red snapper, all this stuff, people within reason.
Bob, we've got it, the fisherman's view, and it comes across loud and clear, and we hear it, and thank you for bringing it to us. I mean, it's interesting, Akiko, your book is called Optimistic when it comes to the environmental face here. Bob wants to discount an awful lot there, but you, in a way, you too are saying, don't be afraid of your rivers, Americans.
Well, I think the point I'm trying to make, in so far as this is an environmental book, is that if people can somehow feel personally connected to the landscape around them, in this case, the waterscape, the rivers, then it gives them a sense of, personal stewardship. I mean, taking care of the land, of the environment, can kind of start in a very personal place. That was where I was coming from.
So connect with the river, and you may feel a part of it. David's calling from Bluffton, South Carolina. David, you're on the air. David, hi, are you there?
Hi, how's it going?
Pretty good. What do you know?
Where I live in Bluffton, South Carolina, there's this river called the May River.
Mm-hmm.
And we're really, really proud of this river because it has shellfish quality waters in it. And so it oysters directly from the river, capable of eating. Just right there, fresh oysters.
Beautiful.
Sounds sweet to me. I hate to think of it as a miracle, but I'm really glad that you've got it. And thanks for calling with that. Akiko Bush, stand by for a moment. I want to welcome another voice in here for a couple of minutes. Alec Matheson is with us, joins us from New York, river enthusiast and advocate. He's called the Hudson River Keeper. He's president of River Keeper, based in Tarrytown, New York. It's a group that serves as a kind of watchdog group on environmental health of rivers, bringing polluters to court. He's former special assistant at the U.S. Department of the Interior in the Clinton administration. Alec Matheson, thanks very much for joining us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks very much for having me on.
Aki Bush dives right in the rivers and swims them. Give us a kind of an environmentalist view for a moment. We had a caller just now saying, dive in and don't worry about it. But how do you look at it? As someone who keeps very close tabs on river health and cleanliness, how should Americans look at their rivers? Do you have to take them one by one, inch by inch, mile by mile? Can we have a more relaxed view of getting into the river waters of this country these days, or are they still a danger to get into?
I think that the Americans should take a cautious but increasingly optimistic view of the cleanliness of their waterways. Things have certainly improved over the last 30 years since the passage of the Clean Water Act and other federal statutes that have mandated that companies and municipalities ratchet down their pollution discharges into our waterways. But we still have a real problem. Just looking across the country, still, the EPA estimates that about 45% of our rivers and estuaries and lakes and coastal waters are too contaminated to swim or fish in safely on a consistent basis, and that's unacceptable. You know, the Clean Water Act that was passed in 1972, and at the time, two-thirds of the country's rivers and lakes and coastal waters had become unsafe for fishing and swimming. But at that time, they passed the law, and their goal, Congress's goal, was zero discharge of pollutants into our U.S. waters by 1985, and that all waters would be fishable and swimmable by 1983. Well, we're obviously a long way from that goal. It's 22 years later, and we have not come close to meeting it, so we have a lot more work to do. But that said, I do agree things are improving dramatically, and the Hudson River is a case in point. This is an international success story, and there you actually today can swim along most stretches of the Hudson safely and without fear and without any risk of contamination.
And Alex, where there are risks, on rivers where there are risks, what tend to be the primary causes these days? Is it current effluent and from what? Or is it left over from, you know, from dumping of years past?
Well, you have two primary problems, Tom. One is that much of our sewage infrastructure across the nation is starting to fail. A lot of these systems were installed back in the 1950s and 60s and 70s, and they're no longer operating at the way they were designed to operate. So we're having an increasing number of incidents where treatment plants are actually failing and allowing raw sewage to get into our local waterways. The second very serious problem, especially here on the Hudson, is the problem of what's called combined sewage overflows. A lot of American cities use an antiquated system whereby stormwater, basically rainwater that hits the pavement and flows into storm drains, is combined in the sewage pipes with sanitary sewage and then sent to, in this case, in the case of New York City, 14 sewage treatment plants that exist throughout the five boroughs of New York.
Okay, Alex, here's a test question for you then. We blindfold you, take you to a riverbank, you don't know where it is, and invite you to swim across it. Do you do it or not?
Well, I'll tell you this. The very fact that you blindfolded me would make me perhaps a little
Okay, we gently put our hands over your eyes.
To finish the New York City story, today we had a torrential rain.
Yeah.
Even during moderate to light rains, you have millions of gallons and each year, 27 billion gallons of untreated or partially treated sewage going into our waters. So that does present a real problem. You know, as to your question, you know, I'm an adventurous type, so I think more often than not I jump in and perhaps make sure I keep my mouth closed.
All right. There's a thumbs up. Alec Matheson, Riverkeeper, Hudson Riverkeeper, joining us from New York. Thanks a lot for being here.
You're welcome.
Akiko Bush, what about you? You don't know where you are. There's an American river in front of you. You've crossed eight now. Would you dive in?
I'm with Alec. I'm jumping in. Yeah.
Lynn is calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts, just across the river here. Lynn, thanks for calling.
Hi. How are you?
Very well. What do you know?
My dad was, when he was younger, he's 58 now, he used to swim in the Chalice River. And he loved it. And when we were teenagers, my brother and I, he'd take us out on his boat and on the Charles, and he'd say, "No, don't jump in. It's too dirty. It's gross. It's disgusting." You know, when I was younger, I used to swim in it.
Was this near the city, near Boston or Cambridge, Lynn, or was it upriver? Where?
It was by the Museum of Science down towards the...
Right in the middle of the city. Okay. Okay.
Yeah. So, and now it seems like they're trying to clean it up a little, which is, I'm glad. It's nice. It's, brings back memories that if you could go into it or even just play around it, you know.
So have you done it? Would you do it? Would you dare?
I don't know. It's very brown. But I don't know if that's just because that's the way the water looks or... I don't know.
Yeah, that's the question. A lot of Americans might ask at the river's edge. Thanks for that. Let's see if we can get an answer. We've got Renata calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Renata, you're on the air.
Yes, I am. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Well, I'm delighted you're mentioning the Charles River. I grew up on rivers in Switzerland and swam, and now I live here in Cambridge on the Charles River. And actually, this Saturday is going to be the first ever swim in an urban river, a race, a one-mile race put on by the Charles River Swimming Club, and I'm with the Charles River Conservancy.
And will this be right next to Boston or where, Renata?
Oh, yes, it will be right on the off the Esplanade, right between the Longfellow Bridge and the Mass Avenue Bridge, the Harvard Bridge.
And do people have to sign a waiver not holding you accountable if they get, I don't know, toe fungus afterward, or is it clean enough to swim now?
It's, the water is clean enough, and we are working with the Department of Conservation and Recreation. The EPA is testing the water, and so this is a very exciting moment, and we hope that this is the first step to bring urban rivers back to swimming, and the Charles River might well be the first river where it's possible.
Wouldn't that be great if everybody could just head down to the river and take a plunge anytime they felt like it? Saturday, a whole lot of folks out there, I'm sure. Renata, thanks for that. Let's get another from Sally, South Carolina. Bob, you're on the air.
Yes, I just wanted to say that I grew up between the North Fork and the South Fork of the Edisto River, and that is the longest blackwater river in the United States. And we call it blackwater. Mm. The acetanic that comes from the cypress trees and all the trees that come in, the water looks black. but it's very clear. It has a sandy bottom to it and runs all the way to Edisto Beach.
Do you swim it, Bob?
Sir?
Do you swim it? Would you?
Yes, I was raised on it, and we all, my sister, my brother, and I, were taught to swim there. And we were taught because of current water. And you learn how to swim in current water, you can swim anywhere.
Yeah.
But I wanted to tell Miss Bush we would like to invite her to the state of smiling faces and beautiful places to come and see the Edisto and see that it dumps into one of the largest estuarine places in the United States, the Ace Basin, where the Ashipoo, the Fumbie, and the Edisto come together down on the coast. And if we have reserved that, and the logging companies in this part of the country, we have great best management practices called BMPs, and we have to keep a certain distance from the river so it creates sort of a marsh or something,
mm-hmm.
and all runoff clean before it goes into the river.
Bob, you paint a good picture, and it's a sweet invitation. Akika Bush, black water, but clean water, Bob says.
I accept the invitation with great pleasure, great pleasure. I just want to say something else about what he just said, which is I love the idea of learning to swim in a current. I haven't heard about that before, and it's a lovely image. It's a great way to learn to swim.
What was it like for you? Where did you face the current that made a real difference? The Connecticut was so lazy you could just paddle about. Did you have real, a battle with the current anywhere?
Well, I've been in the Hudson a couple of times when we didn't quite get our timing right. And so certainly the tide and the current in the Hudson can be very, very strong, overpowering in some cases. So certainly there. But yes, I think in this series of swims, it was certainly the Mississippi that was presented the strongest current.
Well, tell us about the Mississippi. That one really caught my attention because, that's a river I know fairly well, and it's, of course, so wide. There are places where I can't imagine swimming across it. But there was one year, 10 or 15 years back, there was drought. The Mississippi got real tiny. I was down in Cairo, Illinois, reporting on that drought, and the river was, I'd never seen it so small. And I literally stood by it, with my toes in the mud, thinking if I'm ever going to swim it, this would be the time. And I have to admit, I quailed. I didn't have the nerve. I thought, it also means whatever's in there is more concentrated than ever. And I didn't do it. But you did. Where'd you dive in? What was it like?
Well, Cairo is where I think the Ohio comes in and meets the Mississippi. We did about 30 miles north of that.
Mm-hmm.
So it was between where the Missouri comes in and the Ohio comes in. We did it at Cape Girardeau. It was probably about a mile across where we did it. That, like the Hudson, was a river where we were very, very careful. We had to do some pretty deliberate advanced planning. We, finding a guide and a boat and making sure that we were, with people who knew the river because we didn't. But again, that was a river where, there's this incredible disconnect that so many people who live on the waterfront have, where they love the river and they feel this sense of kind of protectiveness and stewardship, and they sit by the river in the evening and watch it, and they kind of, have this amazing relationship with the river, but then talk about getting in, and, they're horrified. They don't want to have anything to do with that. So that was, I think, we ran into that at the Mississippi, probably, that kind of schizophrenic response to rivers more than we did anywhere else.
What about the barge traffic? The Mississippi can look like a railroad track sometimes with those gigantic barges and tugs going up and down. You'd be a little tiny speck next to them. How'd you steer clear of that?
Yeah, you'd be a nut. But we had a boat. We had an escort and a boat. We had a great guide, a guy named Jody Geiser, who knew the river like the back of his hand. He used to be an engineer, and he'd go up and down the river, so he knew all the right spots. And he found us a boat and knew where to go, knew where we should get in. And he had planned it so that he didn't know how far we would be swept downstream. So on the opposite side, on the Illinois side, there were, a series of beaches, a series of little sandy beaches. And he said, you can go there, you can go there, you can go there. Just wherever you end up is going to be fine. So that was one of those rivers where we jumped in without knowing where we'd end up. But
and how far south did the current take you before you got across that mile?
Yeah, probably, my guess is about 3/4 of a mile, maybe. I mean, that was,
Not
it was
bad.
A kind of an amazing experience because we just, when you're in that kind of current, you have no idea how fast it really is. And it's not until you look up and see the bank, things on the bank receding so quickly that you realize how fast you're moving. And obviously, you don't try to fight it or resist it. You just kind of go with it, which is a pleasure.
In the Ohio River, you met your match. You went out to swim across. You didn't do it. Why not?
Well, that was right after we'd swum the Mississippi, and the Mississippi required so much advance planning, phone calls and schedules and dates, that when we were done with that, we'd kind of had enough of that. So we just kind of, my friend Annie and I, who swam those two rivers, or swam the Mississippi with me, we just kind of jumped into our rental car and said, let's go to the Ohio. And we did absolutely no advance planning and paid for it because, again, the Ohio's a river you're not going to get into without an escort boat. And we just, we counted on serendipity and luck. And I don't know about your life, but anytime I've ever counted on serendipity and luck, they don't show up. So that was the river. We went there. We looked at it. We stepped into it. We even swam in it, but we didn't swim across it.
Yeah, over by Paducah and just not going across the Ohio. Yeah. Well, Matt's calling from Yorktown, Virginia. Hi, Matt. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Yeah.
Well, a little bit about me. I live on the York River, and I work at Yorktown. I'm a historical interpreter there. And at the Battle of Yorktown, in the Revolutionary War, that's when the British forces surrendered to General Washington.
Sure.
And bringing the war to an end. And the York River that I swim in played a very big part of that. The French Navy was actually able to take control of the Chesapeake Bay and bring its ships right up the York River and sit right on the river, which is just right out the window from where I work.
So would you plunge in, Matt?
All the time. Every day after work, just about, we go swimming. The riverfront area got hit pretty hard with some hurricanes in the past couple of years, and they've done a lot to actually rebuild the riverfront. And now the riverfront, where it used to just be sort of a small place, is now really built up. It's where families come for picnics every day. There's some nice little stores in there. It's where high school kids take their dates there now. It's a place where I think the local community is taking a real stewardship of the river, and since so much was damaged in the storms, we're starting to really appreciate it now. And I think that's great because it really does tie us back into our history and you know, put sort of the history of the revolution and of our area into perspective.
And a good,
I think the river does a big part of that.
Yeah, and a good swim on a hot day, Matt. Thanks for taking us to that Yorktown then and now. Let's go to Terry in Virginia Beach, Virginia. Hi, Terry. You're on the air.
Hi. I went to Military College of Vermont, Norwich University, and all the incoming freshmen, because it is a military college, go through a hell week. And at the end of the hell week, after an obstacle course, one of the things the freshmen do is free builder, is run the river behind the college. We run, you know, with our incoming class. And
now, when you say run the river, do you mean swim across it, down it?
Well, it's not too, the portion that runs right behind our college is not too deep. There's parts that kind of go up to your neck. So, you know, you're in full camouflage or battle fatigue, so you know you're exhausted by the end of the day. So you're kind of, and some people are shorter than others, so you're helping each other across and through down the river. It's about a quarter of a mile stretch that we actually do behind the river.
So you're in battle. You're in battle gear in military school, and is it a relief or is it a challenge?
Yeah, and so it's part of the challenge, but it's the end of the day and it's the end of the week, and at that point you're considered, you know, part of, you know, the student body, the military student body of our college. And it's something that we always go back to and remember. It's, you know, the culmination of the first, you know, our first indoctrination in school. And we always go back to it, and it's something that we did, you know, we completed our first week, you know, at our university, and you know, coming back to it every single year, and we picnic on it as alumni and as upperclassmen, you know, we would barbecue out there and on warm days in Vermont, which are very few, so 50 degrees is a warm day.
Yeah.
We'd go out there and go swimming, and we call it the Dog River, and there's a, every year there's an alumni Dog River golf tournament. It's a small little river in Northfield, Vermont.
And then you're ready to go. We, you know, I hear it again, this sort of take me back, throw me in the river right now. Terry, thanks. Let's go to Willsboro, New York on Akiko Bush's Hudson River. Scott's calling. Hi, Scott.
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to call in. Just I grew up on the upper Hudson River outside of Glens Falls.
Mm.
And we used to jump into the dam as the water came over the dam, and float with the current to find lures. That's how we found our fishing lures. And after floating for a while, we'd go back up and go ahead and catch fish.
Would you do it now, Scott? Does it look inviting, seem inviting now?
Absolutely. I live up in the Adirondacks and swim the lakes and rivers everywhere we can find them.
Yeah, that's good. Hudson, thumbs up right there. And let's get one more from Highway 91 in South Carolina. Jake's driving his big rig. Jake, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, it's 95 I'm on.
Oh, good. 95, all right. We want to keep you on the right path with your truck. What do you know, Jake?
Oh, I grew up on the Ohio River, right there in the town of Wheeling, West Virginia. As a kid, I played in the river. I swam in the river. I fished in the river. It was the biggest part of my life.
Would you go back in today, Jake? Is it clean enough for you now?
Yes, I'd do it today if I could.
I bet you would, and we hope you get to a good one. Thanks for that. Akiko Bush, how about it? You've got a lot of musings in here. It's not just a crossing you've got in mind, and it's not just an environmental message. There is a kind of a pilgrimage involved in your crossings as well, and a kind of a philosophical journey. Where did it take you?
Oh, I'm not sure there was any final destination. I think it's still taking me there. I think I just, when I started this whole... when I started swimming, I just saw the river as a kind of place to begin thinking about these things or begin addressing these, you know, thoughts about getting older, your kids getting older, you know, where it's all going to take you. There's no final destination. I'm still kind of floating along. But I wanted to say, listening to all of these stories, which are so wonderful and so inspiring, one of the things I keep hearing is people saying, oh, this is what I did when I was a kid, and you know, my father told me this, or you know, my parents used to do this, and you know, it's clear to me that we used to have this really intimate relationship with these waterways, and that you know, it's something we can have again, but it's kind of in our collective memory. You know, we all have some memory of that, and it's just lovely to hear these stories that draw on that memory.
It sure is. We've just got a minute. Take us out for one more image. The Current River down there feeding the Ozarks, a pretty splendid spot as you swam it. Paint a picture for us.
Well, I'd never heard of the Current River before, but when we were at the Mississippi in Missouri, everyone said, oh, you've got to go to the Current River. It's kind of, you know, the antidote to the mighty Mississippi. It's, I think some 70% of the river is fed by these deep natural springs, so the water is absolutely crystal clear.
Is it Missouri, Arkansas, both?
Where we were, it was in Missouri, and then it does go down to Arkansas, I do believe. But there was something about the last river we were in being this narrow, winding, clear, clean river that nobody had any problem with, that was seemed like the right place to end this journey.
What's your next destination? Where have you been swimming since?
I don't know. I was fascinated listening to that woman talking about the swim in Boston. I'm thinking maybe, you know, I didn't do any urban rivers in my book, so maybe that's next. Something I'm thinking about but haven't made any decision on.
Well, it's that's a great way to go. I guess now every summer you're putting pins in your map and deciding which river you're going to be getting into. Akiko Bush, it's been wonderful speaking with you. We're very grateful to you for joining us. Thanks a lot for being here.
Thanks, Tom. A total pleasure.
Akiko Bush joining us there from New York. Swimming rivers is her thing. The Hudson is where she began. Tells it all in a new book, 9 Ways to Cross a River, Midstream Reflections on Swimming and Getting There from Here. We go out with a poem from Langston Hughes. The Negro speaks of rivers.
I've known rivers. I've known rivers ancient as the world and older than the flow of human blood in human veins. My soul has grown deep like the rivers. I bathed in the Euphrates when dawns were young. I built my hut near the Congo, and it lulled me to sleep. I looked upon the Nile and raised the pyramids above it. I heard the singing of the Mississippi when Abe Lincoln went down to New Orleans, and I've seen its muddy bosom turn all golden in the sunset. I've known rivers, ancient, dusky rivers. My soul has grown deep like the rivers.